Chapter 11. Since climbing the World's View Road out of Pietermaritzburg, Sean and Imbajani had travelled in sunshine and in companionship. The feelings between them were solid, compacted by time and the pressure of trouble and shared laughter into a shield of affection, so that now they were happy as only men can be together. The jokes were old jokes, and the responses almost automatic. But the excitement between them was new, in the same way that each day's sun is new. For they were riding to war, to another meeting with death, so that everything else lost significance. Sean felt free. The thoughts and relationships with other people, which had weighed him down over the past months, slipped away. Like a ship, clear for action, he hurried with a new lightness to meet his chance. At the same time, he could stand aside from himself and grin tolerantly at his own immaturity. By God, we're like a couple of kids sneaking out of school. Then, following the thought further, he was suddenly thankful. Thankful that this was so. Thankful that there was still this capacity to forget everything else and approach the moment in childlike anticipation. For a while, this new habit of self-appraisal asserted itself. I am no longer young, and I have learned much. Gathered it brick by brick along the way, and trimmed each brick and cemented it into the wall. The fortress of my manhood is not yet completed, but what I have built so far is strong. Yet the purpose of a fortress is to protect and hold safely those things that are precious. If, during the building, a man loses and expends those things which he wishes to protect, then the finished fortress is a mockery. I have not lost it all. A little I have used in barter. I have traded a little faith for the knowledge of evil, exchanged a little laughter for the understanding of death, a measure of freedom for two sons, and this was a good trade. But I know there is still something left. At his side, Imbajani noticed the change of Sean's mood, and he moved in front of it to turn it once more into the sunshine.
Nkosi, we must hurry if you wish to reach your drinking place at Freya.
With an effort, Sean thrust his thoughts aside and laughed. They rode on into the north, and on the third day they reached Chivli. Sean remembered his innocent amazement when, as a youth, he had joined Lord Chelmsford Column at Rorke's Drift at the beginning of the Zulu War. He had believed then no greater accumulation of men was possible. Now he looked out across the encampment of the British army before Colenso and smiled. Chelmsford's little force would have been lost in the artillery and ordnance park, yet beyond that the tent stretched away for 2 miles, row upon row upon row of white canvas cones with the horse lines in between, and to the rear the orderly acres of transport vehicles, thousands of them, with the draft animals scattered, grazing across the felt, almost to the range of the eye. It was an impressive sight, not only in its immensity but also in its neat and businesslike layout. So was the military precision of the blocks of men at drill, the massed glitter of their bayonets as they turned and marched and countermarched. When Sean wandered into the camp and read the names of the regiments at the head of each row of tents, he recognised them as the sound of glory. But the new khaki uniforms and pith helmets had reduced them all to a homogeneous mass. Only the cavalry retained a little of the magic in the pennants that fluttered gaily at their lance tips. A squadron trotted past him, and Sean eyed their mounts with envy. Great shiny beasts, as arrogant as the men upon their backs, horse and rider given an air of inhuman cruelty by the slender, bright-tipped lance they carried. A dozen times Sean asked his question, "Where can I find the guides?" And though the answer was given in the dialects of Manchester and Lancashire, in the barely intelligible accents of Scotland and Ireland, each had a common factor. They were all singularly unhelpful. Once he stopped to watch a group training with one of the new Maxim machine guns. Clumsy, he decided, no match against a rifle. Later he would remember this judgment and feel a little foolish. All morning he trudged through the camp, with Mbijani trailing him, and at noon he was tired and dusty and bad-tempered. The Natal Corps of Guides appeared to be a mythical unit. He stood on the edge of the camp and looked out across the open felt, pondering his next move in the search. Half a mile out on the grassy plain, a thin drift of blue smoke caught his eye. It issued from a line of bush that obviously marked the course of a stream. Whoever had picked that spot to camp certainly knew how to make himself comfortable in the veld. Compared to the bleak surroundings of the main encampment, it would be paradise, protected from the wind, close to firewood and water, well away from the attention of senior officers. That was his answer. Sean grinned and set out across the plain. His guess was proved correct by the swarm of black servants among the trees. These could only be colonial troops, each with a personal retainer. Also, the wagons were drawn up in the circular formation of the laager. With a feeling of homecoming, Sean approached the first white man he saw. In an enamel hip bath beneath the shade of a mimosa tree, this gentleman sat waist-deep while a servant added hot water from a large black kettle. "Hello," Sean greeted him. The man looked up from his book, removed the cheroot from his mouth, and returned Sean's greeting. "I'm looking for the guides." "Your search has ended, my friend. Sit down." Then to the servant, "Bring the Nkosi a cup of coffee." Thankful, Sean sank into the rimpi chair near the bath and stretched his legs out before him. His host laid aside the book and began to lather his hairy chest and armpits while he studied Sean with frank appraisal.
"Who's in charge here?" Sean asked.
"You want to see him?"
"Yes."
The bather opened his mouth and yelled,
"Hey, Tim!"
"What do you want?"
The reply came from the nearest wagon.
"Fellow here to see you. Or what's he want?"
"Says he wants to talk to you about his daughter."
There was a long silence while the man in the wagon digested this. Then,
"Oh, what's he look like?"
"He's a big bloke with a shotgun."
"You're joking."
"The hell I am. Says if you don't come out, he's going to come in to get you."
The canvas of the wagon canopy was lifted cautiously, and an eye showed beneath the slit. The ferocious bellow that followed startled Sean to his feet. The canvas was thrown aside, and out of the wagon vaulted the commanding officer of the guides. He moved in on Sean with his arms held like a wrestler. For a moment, Sean stared at him. Then he answered the bellow and dropped into a defensive crouch.
"Yah!"
The man charged, and Sean met him chest to chest, locking his arms around him as they closed.
"Tim Curtis, you miserable bastard! Ha ha!"
he roared in laughter and in pain, as Tim tried to pull his beard out by the roots.
"Sean Courtney, you evil son of a bitch!"
Breathless as the air was forced from his lungs by Sean's hug.
"Let's have a drink!"
Sean punched him.
"Let's have a bottle!"
Tim caught his ears and twisted. At last they broke apart, and stood laughing incoherently in the pleasure of meeting again. The servant returned with Sean's coffee, and Tim waved him away disgustedly.
"Ah, none of that slop. Get a bottle of brandy out of my chest."
You two know each other, I presume?"
the man in the bath interrupted them.
"Know each other? Jesus, I've worked 5 years for him," snorted Tim. "Digging his dirty gold out of the ground, worst boss I ever had."
"Well, now's your chance," Sean grinned, "because I've come to work for you."
"You hear that, Saul? The idiot wants to join."
"Muzzle tough."
The bather dunked the tip of his cheroot in his bathwater, flicked it away, and stood up. He offered Sean a soapy hand. "Welcome to the Legion of the Lost. My name's Saul Friedman. I gather yours is Sean Courtney. Now where's that bottle and we'll celebrate your arrival?" The commotion had summoned the others from their wagons, and Sean was introduced to each of them. It seemed the uniform of the guides was a khaki tunic, without insignia or badges of rank, slouch hats and riding breeches. There were 10 of them. A tough-looking bunch, and Sean found their company to his liking. Naked, except for a towel draped round his waist, Saul did duty as barman. Then they all settled down in the shade to a bout of drinking. Tim Curtis entertained them for the first 20 minutes with a biographical and biological account of Sean's career, to which Saul contributed comments that were met with roars of laughter. It was obvious that Saul was the company wit, a function which he performed with distinction. He was the youngest of them all, perhaps 25 years old, and physically the smallest. His body was thin and hairy, and in a pleasant sort of way he was extremely ugly. Sean liked him. An hour later, when the brandy had taken them to the stage of seriousness which precedes wild and undirected hilarity, Sean asked,
"Captain Curtis?"
"A lieutenant, and don't forget it,"
Tim corrected him.
"Lieutenant, then.
What is our job, and when do we do it?"
Tim scowled at his empty glass, and then looked across at Saul.
"Tell him," he instructed.
"As mentioned earlier, we are the Legion of the Lost. People look on us with pity and a mild embarrassment. They pass us by on the far side of the street, making the sign of the cross and murmuring a spell to avert the evil eye. We live here in our own little leper colony.
Or why?
Well, first of all, we belong to the most miserable little runt in the entire army of Natal, an officer who, despite a formidable array of medals, would not inspire confidence in a young lady's choir. He's chief liaison officer for the colonial troops on the general staff, Lieutenant Colonel Garrick Courtney, VC, DSO.
Saul paused, and his expression changed. No relation of yours, I trust.
No, lied Sean without hesitation.
Thank God, Saul continued.
Anyway, this is why people pity us. The embarrassment arises from the fact that nobody recognizes our official existence. Even the drawing of rations must be preceded by a comic opera dialogue between Tim and the quartermaster. But because we are called guides, everybody expects us to get out there and start doing a bit of guiding. So in some weird fashion, the failure of General Buller to advance even 100 yards in 3 months is laid at our door.
Saul filled his glass.
Anyway, we haven't run out of brandy yet.
You mean we don't do anything? Sean asked incredulously.
We eat, we sleep, and we drink.
Occasionally we go visiting, Tim added. Now is a good time as any.
Who do we visit?
There is a most enterprising woman in the area, not 5 miles distant. She owns a travelling circus, 40 wagons, and 40 girls. They follow along behind the main army to comfort and encourage it. Let's go and get some comfort and encouragement. If we start now, we'll get to the head of the line. First come, first served.
I'll leave you to it, Saul stood up and drifted away.
He's a good kid, Tim observed as they watched him leave.
Is it against his religion?
No, but he's married and takes it seriously. How about you?
I'm not married.
Well, let's go, then.
Much later, they rode home together in the moonlight, both pleasantly melancholy with love and liquor. The girl who had taken Sean to her bosom was a friendly lass with a pair of fat maternal bosoms.
"I like you, mister," she had told him afterwards.
"I like you also," he replied truthfully.
Although Sean experienced no more shame or guilt than after satisfying any of his other bodily needs, yet he knew that half an hour with a stranger in a wagon bed was a very poor substitute. He began to hum the tune that Ruth had sung on the night of the storm.